When I think about this story, I imagine that Mary really wanted to say no when that angel showed up and said, "Congratulations, you've been chosen. You've been chosen to be pregnant and unwed in a patriarchal society where you could be stoned to death." It's not exactly the glad tidings I would want from an angel. And yet, Mary ends up in that passage, which is not the one we read, but is earlier in the story. She ends up saying yes, or rather, "Let it be according to your word," which is maybe not the most enthusiastic yes. But we know men were writing this story, so that's how it goes. And she shows up at her friend Elizabeth's, or her cousin, rather, I think it's her cousin Elizabeth's house in the passage we read, And this young woman who is in this society that not only doesn't really value her as a woman, but also she's part of an occupied people under this empire that we know used very, very violent means to control the people they occupied, including crucifixion, which obviously features later in the story, but was used very commonly and widely in these times. And she says, "My soul magnifies the Lord." And I think that that is really powerful. And then she goes on to talk about what kind of God this is that she is magnifying. Not only is it her personally being empowered and blessed, but this God is a God who brings down the powerful and lifts up the lowly, who fills the hungry and sends the rich away empty. So this flipping is happening on a communal level. And then later she says God has helped her servant Israel, which is her whole people, her people that she's referring to, which is a people who are a rather small ethnic religious group in this landscape of war and factions and empire. A small, scrappy little group that really has stuck to their stories and their God. And this group is also lifted up as compared to the Roman Empire. This flipping is happening on bigger and bigger levels. Well, this time of year for Christians is a time of waiting. And yes, it's definitely waiting for Christmas, and many of us, no matter what our religious affiliation, do enjoy waiting for Christmas, whether we celebrate it secularly or religiously. But it's also a time of waiting for the second coming of Christ, a time for God to make things right, finally. And I have to say, even though I really deeply appreciate Christian scripture and practice, I'm not much for any literal interpretation of this coming that would involve a descending from the clouds and a judgment of who is in and who is out. That kind of thing doesn't work well for my universalist philosophy and my Unitarian beliefs. But I will say that I really do long for that kingdom of God to be on earth as it is in heaven. I really do long for some of that flipping. And I have to say, these days I long for it more than ever, as it seems that things are only getting worse, with the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer instead of better. And in Advent, in the Christian practice, it is a time for hopeful and active waiting. There's a lot of passages that are read this time of year for Christians that are about staying awake, alert. It's a readiness. It's not a passive waiting, like, "Okay, Jesus, would you show up already? It's like really getting bad down here." It's like we are making the kingdom of God on earth. And even though I really love that perspective in theology, I have to say it is hard sometimes for me to keep up with the active, hopeful waiting. And sometimes, especially these days, I just want to throw up my hands and say, "Never mind, we're doomed. I'm not going to wait. I'm not going to think anything's going to change. I just feel like I'm trying to empty the ocean with a little eyedropper here, and it's not going anywhere." But one text that has given me some hope recently is this book called Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Marie Brown. And she describes herself as a pleasure activist, which I think is a really interesting description. And she is a multiracial Black woman from Detroit. And she wrote this text drawing on three different sources. One source is the natural world and looking at how change happens in the natural world. Another source is Black science fiction, particularly work by Octavia Butler. Some of you may be familiar with Octavia Butler. And then the third thing is drawing on social movements and how those create change. And so Emergent Strategy is this theory of change that she draws on from these sources. And one of the key elements, in fact, the first element that she lists when she lists the sort of elements of Emergent Strategy is that life is fractal. And it's sort of related. She has this list of elements of the strategy, and it's related to a verse from Octavia Butler, from her book, The Parable of the Sower. And it goes like this. All successful life is adaptable, opportunistic, tenacious, interconnected, and fecund. Understand this, use it, shape God. That's from Parable of the Sower. And so what Adrienne does with this list is she kind of creates her own parallel list of what she's seeing when she draws on the natural world and social movements that kind of is similar. And the first thing she says, parallel to the words all successful life, is the word fractal. And so I was looking up what a fractal is, because even though I kind of had a sense of what she was talking about and could kind of picture like a swirly design, I wasn't totally sure what a fractal was. So the dictionary says, it is a curve or a geometric figure, each part of which has the same statistical character as the whole. So every part has the same character as the whole. And it says that fractals are useful in modeling structures, such as eroded coastlines or snowflakes, in which similar patterns occur at progressively smaller scales. And it's useful in describing random or chaotic phenomena, such as crystal growth, fluid turbulence, and galaxy formation. So I was already thinking, wow, this is used for snowflakes and galaxy formation. Those are pretty different. And it made me think again about this text where we're going from Mary, the one person in this context magnifying God, to the whole people of Israel that she's talking about, the small and the big. And the way Adrienne Marie Brown describes this concept and how it applies to her life is like this. She writes, I am a cell-sized unit of the human organism, and I have to use my life to leverage a shift in the system by how I am as much as with the things I do. This means actually being in my life, and it means bringing my values into my daily decision making. Each day should be lived on purpose. And I really like that idea. And I also know that it's really complicated stuff, this relationship between small and large scale change. And I think that's especially true when we think about social issues. It made me think about my friend Ryan, who's a friend of mine from high school. And after college, he worked for Greenpeace. And I went out to visit him where he was living in Washington, D.C. And I saw him just throwing his plastic and aluminum right in the trash. And I said, Ryan, where's your recycling? And he said, I don't recycle. And I said, what, you work for Greenpeace? And he said, yeah, I know, that's the point. Recycling doesn't matter, nothing we can do personally matters. The only thing that matters is the policy change and the corporations and the getting the limits on them, and nothing any person can do can affect climate change, and anybody who thinks their recycling matters is just out of their mind. And I was like, whoa, okay. It's a very strong stance against personal recycling. And I understood where he was coming from. I understood his passion, his frustration with how little impact he could make alone and with how important it was to do the largest scale change and with how that wasn't happening and with how doomed we are. I could really get where he was coming from. And at the same time, I just struggled with that. I just struggled with it because it didn't feel aligned. It felt out of joint to have your life go one way and your work go another. And I've struggled with this kind of dilemma my whole life. Even when I was a teenager, I won one of those pick the minister sermon topics that you can sometimes win in an auction. I don't know if you do that here, but some churches do that. And my UU church back home in Illinois did that. And I wanted the minister to preach about ethical consumerism because I really wanted to buy those name brand jeans that all my friends were wearing, but I also really did not want to support horrible factories that underpaid their workers and exploited people. And this was one of the first big ethical dilemmas I was dealing with as a teenager, understanding that my little choices were part of a big system of evil. And then also knowing that my little one purchase was not going to change the big system of evil, that tension. But what I love about Adrienne Marie Brown's understanding of life as fractal is that it's not about so much causing the change as it is about practice. And I really like how she framed it. I was at a workshop that she gave. And at this workshop, she said to us, "Who here practices democracy really well in their family?" And a few people raised their hand and she said, "Does your family include children? And do you include the children in the democracy?" And a few more hands went down. And then she said, "What about in your neighborhood, on your block? Just your block that you live on. Do you practice democracy there to make decisions?" Almost all the hands went down. She said, "What about in your larger neighborhood where you live?" You know, if I'm thinking about where I live, I might think about Forest Hills neighborhood. I live near the Forest Hills stop on the Orange Line. And pretty soon there were no hands up. And then she said, "Now why? Why do we think that we are going to be able to have an effective democracy in our country? We can't even practice it in our neighborhoods." And I was like, wow, that's a good point. Hadn't thought about it that way. And it really got me thinking about the importance of practicing our values on small scales so that we can get better at them for the bigger scales. And I was thinking about that the other day when I was having a frustrating moment with my toddler. I was trying to put her to bed and she was doing something, and I don't even remember what she was doing, but she kept doing something that I didn't want her to do over and over, and I kept giving her warnings and telling her to stop. And finally I said, "You know what, if you do that one more time, we are not reading a book before bed." We usually read a book before bed and she likes that a lot. And so she did the thing again and I said, "Okay, we're not reading a book." And as she was very upset about this, my partner walked by and wondered what all the fuss was about. And I said, "Well, she kept doing this thing and I told her she couldn't read a book." And he said, "Wait, do we really want to be taking books away from her? Is that like our parenting strategy?" And I was like, I'm just frustrated. But it made me think because, you know, politically, I don't believe in punitive justice. I'm a prison abolitionist and I think our current system is not just dysfunctional, but based on some false premises that the best way to support humans in behaving well is to threaten them with punishment. That's just not, that doesn't ring true with how I understand humanity. And to me, I think it makes a lot more sense to focus on the person who was harmed and see what they need to move forward and heal and see if the person who did the harm can contribute to that. And we call that restorative justice, as you may know. Or we can also examine why the person who did the harm was doing it, and maybe we can change some of the conditions that led to that situation, and we call that transformative justice, right? And I believe in these things on the big scale. So then why was I practicing punitive justice with my 2-year-old? Well, because that's what we know, right? That's what we've been taught. That's what we do in schools. That's the water we swim in.
So next time, I was dealing with some frustrating behavior with my two-year-old. She was breaking some of the ornaments on the Christmas tree. And I went over to her and explained to her, you know, this is our Christmas tree. We share it with our house. These ornaments belong to our housemates. You can't break them. And I said, "Kit, so can you stop breaking the ornaments?" And she said, "No." "Okay, is there anything we can do to help you stop breaking the ornaments? Maybe we can transform the conditions." "No." "You just really have to break Christmas ornaments?" "Yeah." "Okay, well then, we're just going to have to make sure you're not near the Christmas tree until you can figure out how to not break the ornaments." "Okay." Walks away. Shared this boundary with everyone else in our house. Don't let Moira near the Christmas tree until she can stop breaking the ornaments. And that went a little better than the whole book situation. And I actually ended up posting about it on Facebook. I thought it was kind of a funny exchange because she was so honest about her compulsive need to break the Christmas tree ornaments. And people thought it was very funny, but I said, you know, just trying to practice some transformative justice with my two-year-old. And I really was. I thought, wow, can I apply these principles I believe in to this little tiny interaction with this little tiny person who's going to be very honest with me about whether or not she's going to break the Christmas tree ornaments? And I'm not saying, by the way, that everyone needs to practice transformative justice with their children. If any of you here are parents, you know, do what you need to do. If timeouts are working well for you, just like keep it up, because parenting is really hard. So this is not a parenting advice sermon, but rather just an insight into what fractal life can be like. Because I'm thinking, you know, if I practice transformative justice with my toddler, maybe when I need to practice it in my community, I might be ready. There is there's a co-op community, people who live together in a cooperative house that some of my friends live in. And a few years ago, they had an incident where one of their housemates stole a significant sum of money from the house funds. And this caused a lot of emotional and financial harm to the community. And there was a lot of tension in the community around how to address it, because while many people in the community believed theoretically in restorative justice, they also really wanted to call the police. And that's understandable, because when you're the one betrayed and your money is stolen, it's an understandable impulse. But there was someone in that community who had experience practicing restorative justice and was able to move them towards a process. And the process was not perfect. And they honestly didn't think they were really going to get any money back. But it is, I am happy to say that at this point that the person who stole the money is slowly paying it back. They don't know if they'll recuperate it all or how long it will take, but it's in the works. And it doesn't always end that well, but in this case, it was possible for a community to try because someone had been practicing. And I saw that on the communal level, but this summer I was able to witness, unfortunately, because I wish this crime had not happened, but unfortunately have seen how that might work on the systemic level. You may have heard, because it was shared on social media, that this summer at General Assembly in New Orleans, two staff members from the Unitarian Universalist Association were violently attacked and robbed. And there was very, very serious harm done, particularly to one of those people, and he was in very critical condition in the hospital. The legal system was involved immediately, and that was not something we were prepared or able to prevent. But I will say that as this process has moved forward, those folks who were harmed and robbed have been participating as much as possible in a restorative process, working with people in New Orleans who do restorative justice and trying to advocate with the legal system to allow a different process than putting these young black homeless men into prison for a very, very long time, which is the most likely outcome. And this is possible partially because of these very dear staff members who are wonderful men, and also partially, again, because there was someone in the mix
who said, I have practiced this before and I know how this works and I will call the restorative justice person and I will have those hard conversations with these people who were harmed and see what feels right to them and what they want to do, and was able to make this process come into motion because of practice. And that is, I know, what the fractal looks like, that if we don't practice on the little scale, when it comes time to the big scale, when we have that moment, we aren't gonna know, we aren't gonna be able, even if those are our values, to act on them, because it's hard. And so I'm curious to go back to that meditation moment we had and to think about what your heart wants to say yes to. Because everyone is in a different place to say yes to something different. For you, it might not be transformative justice. It might not be that issue. But I bet there's something in you that your heart wants to say yes to because of something that's broken in our society. So maybe you are seeing how greed is driving our economic policies and you want to intervene. And maybe you can practice generosity and faith in abundance on every scale that you can access. Or maybe, you know, it's the culture of sexism and sexual harassment that has been really becoming more public and more in our awareness these days. And maybe it's practicing consent and respect on every level that we can. There's so many different ways that we can practice our best yeses so that we can say no to those things that are harming our society and all of us. Because it's not just the no, right? Sometimes I forget when I'm trying to take apart the bad things and say, no, I don't want the prison industrial complex, and no, I don't want deportations, and no, I don't want sexism, but we have to practice the thing we want instead. And that's something I really appreciate also about the fractal piece. It's always about doing the thing you want to be happening in the world. And Adrienne Marie Brown writes about this a little bit later in her book, and she talks about the people's mic that was used at Occupy Wall Street, where one person would say a phrase, and then the people around them would repeat it, and the people around that would repeat it, and it would echo out. And she talks about that and also social media, where things get shared, and the more they get shared, the more they get shared, as metaphors for the fact that it's what we pay attention to that grows, right? So it's if we find our yes, we can grow our yes. And so I think that we must say those best yeses. And I do think that when we say them, they are hard, and that they do allow us to be we always said we would be, because our souls do magnify whatever we hold most dear. And the thing that I struggle with and that I know is true is that our souls don't magnify the thing that we say we value, but they magnify what we live and what we do and what we practice. And so maybe we can practice and grow our little yes, grow it with our whole being, like a scared, unmarried woman living under the Roman Empire grows her sacred little fetus. We can practice on every scale, every chance we get. And then we will be strong enough to change the whole system, strong enough for our souls to magnify what we hold most sacred and the world we are waiting for could finally arrive.